But first, BC Liberal supporters won't like the first segment of this program because for the next hour, we're going to talk about the failed economic policies of the BC Liberal government. Leading up to the 2013 provincial election, the BC Liberals frontman, Jim Shepherd, who headed the phony organization known as Concerned Citizens for BC, was quoted as saying, "You know, we lived through socialism in BC for 10 years. I know what it looks like, and it's not pretty." Norm Farrell, who is an accountant and author of the blog Insight, is going to take us through the BC Liberal years, and if Jim Shepherd didn't think the NDP years were pretty, he may well describe the Liberal years as ugly. Norm, good to see you again. Thanks for coming in.
Well, it's great to be here, and I'm happy to be in Victoria. It's beautiful out there today.
Now, I want to start by some of the numbers that you've uncovered, and this is information that the mainstream media doesn't report, and it's the salaries for the BC Investment Management Corporation, and looking at the sheet you gave me, there are 40 people making over $250,000 with the BC Investment Management Corporation. Take us through some of these salaries and what the top fellow at the BC Investment Management Corporation makes.
Yeah, we should say that 40 that we counted making more than $270,000 is actually about half of the number of people that they employ there. It's
half the number of people make over $250,000.
Close to that. They've got a few more than that, but at any rate, I like to compare what is happening at BC Investment Management Corporation with what's happening south of here. We've talked about it previously, but the Washington State Investment Board has a similar mandate, and it's actually relatively similar in size, at least with respect to the funds it manages. At the last year end, which was December 2014, Washington State Investment Board was supervising $104 billion. BCIMC was 3 months later. They reported their year end with $123 billion managed.
So they're pretty close.
That's correct. Now, where they really start to diverge is in the cost of operation, the administration of the facilities. At BCIMC, there was a change in CEO this past year. Doug Pierce retired, and he was replaced by Gordon Fife. Doug Pierce was paid $1.7 million for 5 months in 2015. Gordon Fife, his replacement, was paid $2.17 million. For 9 months. So you're looking there at $3.9 million for the CEO position that cost in the last fiscal year.
Now let's compare that to what the head of the Washington State board made.
He made $525,000 last year.
$525,000.
That's right. So it's quite amazing to me.
It is. You have some other numbers. Take us through that.
Well, if you look at the top 10, the highest paid people at the BCIMC, the total is $12 million. The top 10 people average $1.2 million a year. At the Washington State Investment Board, the top 10 people are paid a total of $2.7 million. In other words, they're averaging $270,000. So that's a 4.5 difference. That's gone up substantially from what it was. When I first started looking at this, I was using the number of three times the amount of payment in. And now it's, as I say, closer to between four and five as a factor. And you can see it by way of the growth of salaries for all of the employees at BCIMC. In 2010, it was $24.3 million. In 2015, $53.5 million. So you've gone from 24 up by almost $30 million to $54
million. And, so they've increased it by, the salaries have gone up by $30 million. And some people would say, well, Norm, they invest pension funds for the BC government, and they do a good job, and they bring in billions of dollars. They're worth that. And your response is?
Well, historically, the return by the Washington State Investment Board has been superior to that of the BCIMC. And in the current year, BCIMC is proud of their 14.2% return, and the Washington group is boasting of their 17.1% return. So they outperformed them by a fairly significant sum. And there's another factor that's a little bit hidden. The BCIMC has a lot of their investment in foreign dollars, and the weakness of the Canadian dollar has led to a higher value of those foreign-based investments.
Mm-hmm.
So a large part, a significant part, of the 14% return that BCIMC earned this year is from the relative weakness of the Canadian dollar.
So what we have is that the BC Investment Management Corporation had a 14% return. Washington State's what's the Washington State?
17.1%.
So 3% more. Their top person makes $500,000 a year. In British Columbia, for 9 months, Gordon Fife, the head of the BC Investment Management Corporation, made $2.1 million. And also, listeners, the top 40 people in the BC Investment Management Corporation make over $272,000. There are...
Those were last year's numbers, by the way. And since there's been a 16% overall increase this past year, you can bet that that 272,000 base, which the 40th ranked individual made last in 2013, or fiscal year 2014,
mm-hmm.
in fiscal year 2015, it's probably up by 15% at least.
How much of an increase over the years has the salary budget gone up for BC Investment Management Corporation?
Well, in 2010, it was at a little over $24 million.
Yep.
And so it's grown to $54
million. So it's grown to $54
million. So in 5 years' time, that's 225% of what it was 5 years ago.
So while government is telling everyone else in government to accept restraint, the BC Investment Management Corporation is left on its own to do what it wants, and it's been well over a 100% increase in salaries since 2010.
That's correct.
I mean, it boggles the mind how there can be such a disparity between what happens in Washington State, which has a better performance, and what happens in British Columbia.
Absolutely. I think it's inexcusable, and you can see it in a variety of different high-level jobs in the public service in British Columbia. When TransLink was trying to have a local sales tax passed in the greater Vancouver area, they ran into a lot of trouble by people like me complaining of the fact that they were paying more for their executives than what the New York City Transit Authority was paying, considerably more as well. And that you can find applies to a large number of public corporations where there's been a great deal of restraint on ordinary workers' wages. In the healthcare system, there's been reduction in wages over the last number of years when they started contracting out various jobs. But what there's not been any restraint on to any large degree is at the highest levels of the public service. And I believe that it's a problem throughout the economy to see the highest ranking individuals getting substantial increases in remuneration, where the ordinary workers are basically flat.
And the excuse we always get, Norm, is that if you want good people, you have to pay for them.
That's true, and that's why I put a lot of emphasis on the relative returns of the Washington State organization, which is quite a comparable. And when they look at hiring people down there, they're simply not prepared to pay the kinds of wages that they pay in British Columbia. And they're still getting good people and a stable workforce as well.
Mm-hmm. Norm Farrell is our guest. We welcome your calls. Norm has the blog Insight, and he's here until 2 o'clock. We'll take a break, and we'll come right back.
Informative talk. Now, the Ian Jessup Show.
Welcome back. Norm Farrell is our guest, the author of the blog Insight. Norm's blog always has some information you won't find anywhere else. Let's go to the phones and talk to Ron. Hi, Ron.
Yes, hi. I guess it's fair to say that the folks who work at BC Investment Board get liberal salaries and liberal salary increases. Now, what about the Premier's office? It seemed to me the last gambit they had was she redefined their jobs and gave them a big salary increase. And secondly, do any of these people get performance bonuses on top? Because the last time they fired an ICBC person for incompetence, they also paid him a performance bonus. And yet he was fired.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Do these folks get performance bonuses? Do we know?
Oh, absolutely. Of the $12 million that they spent for key management personnel, that's the top 10 guys this past year, only $3.1 million of that was base salary. The rest of it is framed as annual incentive, long-term incentive plan, other short-term benefits, and post-employment benefits, and pension contributions, and so on. So they certainly frame their salaries as being incentive driven, but if you look at over time, the incentives are paid out every year, and you know if you allow me to design my own salary package and tell me it has to include incentives, you can be certain that I'm going to be able to make the targets.
Yeah. Do you realize, Ron, that last year there were 6 people at the BC Investment Management Corporation who made over $1 million?
Sweet.
6 people. Oh, it's sweet, all right. Thanks, Ron. I appreciate it.
You see some amazing changes, too, like Paul Flanagan in 2009, $425,000, and then $1.1 million in 2015.
Yeah. Now, Norm, is there any oversight on this? Because I never hear of this, and I never heard of it until you started digging into this.
There certainly is a board of directors that supervises BC Investment Management Corporation. The fact is, though, that these boards are somewhat, they can't be trusted to be effective, partly because it's sort of like BC Ferries. If you want to be on the board, you have to be a good, loyal insider. Otherwise, you won't get kept on the board. Mm-hmm. And so they don't have real, true outsiders. There are no S-disturbers, you might say,
yep.
that are there to try and make certain that the business operates in the most efficient manner possible. There's quite a pyramid of interest involved in public pensions. You get at the levels like, say, where the teachers contribute a lot of money towards pension plans and their employer does as well. And that's a significant part of what BCIMC invests and manages. And there's a group of trustees that are appointed by both the union and the employer and so on. But again, these things tend to become insular, and they are cooperative with each other, and the people that are not cooperative just simply don't stay in the system. So it's driven in a fashion where the oversight, to my understanding, is just simply not effective.
Norm, I want to switch to another topic, and that deals with government debt. There was an article in Forbes magazine, which you referenced on your Twitter account, and I went in to see it. It talks about forget debt as a percentage of the gross domestic product. It's really much worse. Governments always talk about their debt in relation to the gross domestic product. And this article in Forbes by Jeffrey Dorfman says measuring the national debt or provincial debt as a percentage of GDP may be a common international norm, but it makes little sense since not all national income is collected in taxes. And looking at debt to government tax revenue is more akin to a family's comparison of its debt to its income. And the story of our national debt becomes much scarier. Take us through some of the numbers of the provincial government debt, which Christy Clark said the Liberals will have a debt-free British Columbia during the last election.
Well, we know that one's not coming true. But I think it's worth considering the debt to GDP ratio, which the politicians like to relate.
And the public doesn't, I don't mean to speak for all the public, but most of the public doesn't get it, and I don't get it.
You know, I studied economics at university, and I still have trouble sometimes with the various kinds of national accounts and measurement of productivity and wealth and so on. It's a very complex subject matter. Mm-hmm. And you can find all kinds of academic papers written that that take issue with GDP as a solid measure. It's a useful one, but it's not a solid one. For example, if I go out and grow $1 million worth of organic tulips, those have a particular value, and there's no negative occurrence from the production of that product.
Yeah.
If instead I go off into the bush and do placer mining for $1 million worth of gold, I have may have left behind a trail of destruction and
a cost,
pollution of the water and so on.
Yeah.
Now, this is one of the problems that you have, is that GDP doesn't account for the destruction of the atmosphere or the environment in general, and so it's a troublesome thing, and it's particularly, I think, when this issue is going to be considered if we ever go further down the LNG situation, because there's a situation where the intention is to have a bunch of equipment manufactured elsewhere, brought to British Columbia, installed here with the liberal use of foreign workers. And then they're going to take British Columbia natural gas, for which they pay very modest royalty rates, and then ship it elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that the way international business is conducted, the profits from those transactions will reside overseas as well. So, yet, BC will show a substantially increase in gross domestic product based on this natural gas that gets produced. The only thing is that very little of that value will stick within the province. And so that's an example of why GDP is a poor measure of the province's debt situation. Now, I have looked at this in the current year, where we're, I think, the total of direct provincial debt and contractual commitments and so on, which includes the big $60 billion of BC Hydro debt and so on, mm-hmm. is $165.5 billion. And that's in 2006, it was at $68.5 billion. So it's gone up by $97 billion just since 2006. If you go back to 2001, it was at a little under $34 billion. So the Liberals have seen the provincial debt and contractual commitments grow from $34 billion to $166 billion. And
a significant amount of that is with the independent power projects, which account for $60 billion.
That's correct.
And we've stuck with that.
But if we didn't have those, we'd have had BC Hydro borrowing money to build generation capacity and so on. Now, back in 2001, when there was $34 billion of debt, the annual revenue to government was $24 billion. So that the debt was 140% of annual revenue.
Mm-hmm.
By 2006, that had grown to be 190% of annual revenue, the debt had.
Yeah.
But in 2015, it's at 360%.
So 360%.
Yeah, it's a massive increase.
Norm Farrell is our guest. We're going to continue this conversation after the 1:30 news. Welcome back. Norm Farrell is our guest. He's the author of the blog Insight, and Norm is an accountant who goes through the... you're an accountant, aren't you?
Yep.
Yep. He goes through public accounts and extracts information that many of us can't find. Let's go to the phones and talk to Dave. Hi, Dave.
Hi there.
Hi.
We love your show.
Thank you.
And I really love when Norm comes out with some nice facts and everything.
Comes out with some gems, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. Now, I got one question that'll play to what you like. Do the liberals actually have any good redeeming qualities in their fiscal management? They're always bashing the NDP as fiscal mismanagement, but from what I gather from Norm, most of the time they're worse.
Well, it certainly depends on what your objectives are. I have a great concern about the inability of the government to conduct the business that it conducts. And I think we've discussed that with respect to revenues coming in from mining industries, the forest industry, the natural gas business, and so on, where I don't think we have sufficient boots on the ground to ensure that we're getting all of the money that we should be getting. And we talked last month about the fact that the unit value of per cubic meter that's leaving here in the way of raw logs is far less today than it was previously. Mm-hmm. And that has never been explained adequately to me. And I think that in this day and age, with very sophisticated, very complex operations, multinational operations, you have to have a really strong professional group working for government to ensure that the public is getting what it's due for the resources that it's allowing to be extracted.
Anything else, Dave?
No, I just, I'm totally in agreement with Norm here. Mm. And, you know, it's, I volunteer at hatcheries and stuff like that, and they've taken out the CEOs, parks people, stuff like that, so definitely no boots on the ground.
Well, you look at the situation in China with that dramatic explosion
yesterday.
That I haven't seen the numbers today, but it will result in hundreds of deaths and perhaps thousands. You know, if somebody is doing something, is running a warehouse or a container terminal in British Columbia, is it, or can we be assured that it's being handled safely? Do we have the numbers of inspectors that we should have visiting these facilities,
making certain
that it's done properly? Are we planning to build LNG facilities close by areas where there's great risk of harm? For example, they're talking about LNG operations in the Fraser River and New Westminster area and so on, and Howe Sound up near Campbell River, another one. There's these things are all over the place, and you're going to want to ensure that the work that's done on any one of these facilities is done incredibly well and then is maintained incredibly well.
Thank you, Dave. I appreciate your call.
Okay, have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye. Next caller is Steve. Hi, Steve. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, thanks for having me on. Let's get into some talking about boots on the ground.
Okay.
I'm in the oil and gas industry, and I've talked with Mark before on this about coming on the program. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So I've been involved in the Kitimat project as well, not as well as LNG, as well as the aluminum smelter with Rio Tinto. And nobody seems to talk about the emissions going up in, with the aluminum smelter that provided probably somewhere around 5,000 jobs in Kitimat just for the aluminum smelter reproject that's being overseen right now, and then it's just about completed by Bechtel and Bantrill. As well as I'm in the oil and gas industry, just north of Fort McMurray. I'm a Victoria resident, and I have, for instance, my secretary personally through Suncor probably does about 100 and 150 men and women daily between Sunday and Tuesday leaving from Victoria International Airport. We've got roughly 14,000 men and women that leave Victoria International Airport weekly that go into the oil and gas industry. Not only that, I'd like to just say before, don't cut me off here.
No, Steve.
I'd like to say that, say that the largest land sale out in on Beach Drive at $5.38 million was from oil and gas people from Calgary. Mm-hmm. So we do boots on the ground. We contribute to the economy in British Columbia quite a lot. And I'd just like to say just before I go that we're trying our hardest to make sure that it's done safely and done right. And I'm a manager in the oil and gas industry. And yeah, now that it's down to $42 a barrel, yeah, we're reeling in. But it's our economic growth, and it's what our sustainability is for this province. And we do not have the lumber industry anymore. We don't have it. So we got to look at the natural gas. Yes, we got fracking problems. We do have that. We got to fix that. Yes, we do. But that's our only sustainable resource. So thanks very much.
Okay, Steve, before you go.
Yeah.
Do you want to come on the program sometime?
I'm here for the next 10 days, so I would like to come in and
yeah, unfortunately, I'm off for the next 2 weeks. But,
okay.
But the next time you're here for 10 days, why don't you send me an email and we'll tee something up?
Well, I talked with Mark, one of your producers.
Yeah.
Yeah, about coming on. And I'll tell you, you know, we are really trying, but it's our only sustainable resource that we've got in British Columbia and Alberta. And not only that, but let's just let this one go, that PCL, Suncor, CNRL, all the big five are not hiring anybody from Eastern Canada anymore. You have to provide two pieces of residential, proper residential permanent addresses before you can work in the oil sands. We are not hiring anybody from Eastern Canada anymore.
Okay, that's it.
Yeah, and that's what we're doing.
Okay, so. Steve, you send me an email the next time you're back, and we'll have you on.
Thanks very much.
No problem. Thank you. Let's go to the next caller, and Greg. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Ian. Thanks very much. Norm, it's great to have you on for a whole hour. I really enjoy your segments. I have a comment and a question. The comment concerns the over 300% debt that the Liberals have basically developed. And to that, I think we have to add maybe $20 or $30 billion in LNG debt when a new government comes in and we start to get hard-nosed about fracking and hard-nosed about forever pumping money into that industry to make it viable. And I say that viable in quotes. So I think we've got more debt coming before we have any kind of revenue that will offset that. The question that I have, and it's a complicated one, Norm, is what kind of transfers do we get from the federal government in equalization and probably particularly in equalization as compared to what the Atlantic provinces get? My understanding is that in the Atlantic provinces, the equalization payments constitute up to 40% of their budgets every year. And out here, I can't imagine it's nearly that way. And the concern I have is the equalization system basically derailed because the western provinces are ending up, or the have provinces are ending up supporting the have-not provinces because of constitutional issues that go back 100 years. I'll hang up
okay.
And listen.
Thanks Ray.
It's a good question to ask, and to be honest, I can't throw out answers that I could trust to be accurate, but I'm certainly willing to have a look into it, and I'll put it as a subject to research and perhaps write about it in my blog Insights.
Okay, thank you, Greg. Appreciate it. Next caller is Barbara. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, Ian. Thank you. Would you sometimes get an expert on the government in Switzerland? I understand that politicians don't get a raise before they appeal to the electorate and get an okay. That sounds like a great place to start.
Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
It sounds to me as if that is true, they've got the only real democracy. Because these people that you were talking about earlier are in the cookie jar. They're just having a great time determining for themselves what they're going to have, and they get paid whether they do a good job
Barbara, what we're trying to do here and what Ian's trying to do regularly on his show are to hold some public accountability sessions to talk about the issues and then hope that people will pick up on what is being said here and perhaps further research it, start to ask questions of particularly when there's an election going on. And we want to educate people as to what the facts are as we find them, and we're certainly happy to enter into debate with people if they disagree. But the important thing is for all of us to get engaged and start talking about these issues.
Well, Ian is just tremendous. I've been telling people he's the best thing that's happened to CFACS in all the years I've been listening.
Well, I heard Rafe Mayer giving him high praise.
He's an intellectual, and he's a boat rocker.
Barbara, my head is swelling. Thank you very much.
He just said, thanks, Mom.
Yeah, that's right. Thanks, Mom. One of the things that we try and do, Norm, and there are just under 300 people in the communications arm of the provincial government, and their job is to propagandize government information, and to quite simply, that's what they do for the most part. And our job, and it's the job of the media and those people on talk shows, and a number of bloggers who do excellent work, is to expose the inconsistencies in what they say. And it's as simple as that. We have an email here from Scott. Norm, you can answer this with regard to the 300% debt and revenue. Are you counting the debt of BC Hydro, and are you including the revenue of BC Hydro in your calculation?
I'm counting the debt of BC Hydro because the public is responsible for that. And no, we're not counting the revenue, direct revenue. This is the relationship we're trying to demonstrate is the amount that's coming into government that's available to pay off debt. And I think we're trying to be consistent from why I chose the three different points in 2001, 2006, and 2015, just to show how it's changed over time. But most dramatically, the change has been in recent days.
Norm Farrell is our guest. He's the author of the blog Insight, and we'll take a break and come right back. Welcome back. Norm Farrell is our guest, and he's here until the top of the hour. Let's go to the phones and bring in Mehdi. Hi, Mehdi.
Good afternoon. I'm very grateful for this program. It's interesting that you guys are talking about having an accountability session to bring some accountability. That's the job that we pay handsomely to the opposition to do, and clearly they are not doing that. In the before the last election, we knew about the $60 billion debt for the independent, so-called independent power producer. And the fake opposition that we have, the NDP, didn't say much about that, didn't publicize it during the election. In fact, we know from the internal document of the NDP that their concern was to send a message that people should reduce their expectation. That was their main concern, to tell the people to reduce your expectation. So my question to Norm is this. If we are paying so much to this opposition and they are not fulfilling their obligation to us, why are we bothering with this fake opposition? Why are we not telling the public that we need a new party, to hold these people accountable for what they are doing, the government?
Okay, thank you, Mehdi.
Thank you.
I think the first thing that we need to do is to make the job of an MLA a much more significant one. We are in a situation where decisions get made in the Premier's office or in Ottawa in the Prime Minister's office. There, I understand, in the Prime Minister's office in Ottawa, hundreds of people working there or close to there. And we have MPs and MLAs whose jobs are basically to sit there and vote how they're told on occasion. I had hoped that there would be a substantive discussion about the LNG situation that was just done. Mm-hmm. I read through a lot of Hansard speeches. And I think the NDP did a pretty significant job of bringing out a number of the issues. When I read the government side speaking about those same things, it was just a repetition of talking points, and I don't think it was an effective debate at all. But to have a debate, you have to have more than one party prepared to have it. And you look at the number of days in the course of a year when our legislature is actually in session, and then look at the number of hours in each day, and there's not a heck of a lot of time spent debating the public issues in the legislature, and that's under the control of the governing party.
Yeah. I want to switch topics here just slightly and get back to some numbers, because the BC Liberals have always told us that their government is the great economic manager. They'll create thousands of jobs and everyone will live happily ever after. But if you look at the numbers, which come out from Statistics Canada the first Friday of every month, and the latest numbers show that since the Liberals have been in power, I'll give you a test, Norm, the average number of jobs created each month. Any idea?
It's, I think, got four digits in it.
It's got four digits in it. It's 1,974. Yeah. It sounds impressive. Each month, close to 2,000 jobs are created each month in British Columbia.
What's the population growth, though?
Yeah, the population growth has grown significantly. Christy Clark's job plan, since she announced that, the number of jobs is just over 1,600. So she's not doing very well with her jobs plan. And they, as Jim Shepherd would say, we lived through socialism for 10 years. I know what it looks like, and it's not pretty. Well, if you look during the 10 years the NDP were in power, remember, the Liberals had just under 2,000 jobs per month. Under the NDP, 3,300 jobs were created each month. So what we have is a government propagandizing itself as the great creator of jobs, which it's not, the great creator of balanced budgets, which it's not, that it will eliminate debt, which is increased. The debt under Christy Clark has increased as much as it did under the NDP. And she's only been in power for 5 years. But I want to go on, because we only have a few minutes left, I want to talk about something that you had on your website today, which I found absolutely startling. It was the investment in the Sea to Sky Highway, which the government said initially would cost $400 million.
That was the first announcement, yeah.
$400 million. Take listeners through it in the last couple of minutes we have.
The numbers that I went and looked, not at the press releases that the government has issued, but at the public accounts documents to see how much they'd actually spent or paid to the Sea to Sky Highway Investment Limited Partnership, which is the P3 that is the holder of that highway. And they have, starting in 2006, and then up until the end of fiscal 2015, they had paid $478 million. But they have future obligations that the Auditor General tells us are $699 million. So that'll be a total of almost $1.2 billion
for the highway.
And that's not the entire highway. Turns out that they only contracted a portion of the new highway, and the province paid and built part of it directly, and the P3 paid for part of it as well, or built part of it as well. So we can't separate those numbers out, because they're not the only reason we can look at this, because of the existence of the P3. We can't tell what the province spent directly on the construction of the Sea to Sky Highway.
And one of the problems with public-private partnerships is we don't have total access to the information, or can get access to the information. Do I have that correct?
That's correct. And, you know, the numbers that we're paying each year, it varies, and apparently it's got something to do with the traffic that's on there. And each time somebody drives that roadway, there's what's called a shadow toll that registers to the operator. So the more use the highway gets, the more government has to pay to the P3 operator.
It's like a little turnstile.
That's
it's, like, it's like a slot machine, right?
One of the bloggers, Lila Yule, in Vancouver, was the first to bring up this issue.
Yeah.
And she's also written about some defects in the construction of the highway. They've had to go and do some substantial renovation work on retaining walls and so on because they used a relatively modern system that, if not done properly, can result in huge difficulties.
Yeah, Layla's done a very good job on this. Yeah. Norm, good to talk to you again. Good to see you in town. And we'll have a chat sometime early next month. Appreciate it. Thank you very
Great.
Much.
Thank you.
Norm Farrell, the author of the blog Insight. And I suggest you just Google Insight and you can read Norm's blog, which always has some fascinating information. News is next.